to my life, being able to use what I've gone through to help somebody else just make sense of it all. I don't know.
Ironically, Candace, I was going to talk a bit about that today. And I always like to remind all the patients, so for those who are on the call, because we have quite a few people, excuse me for repeating myself because we're going to recapitulate, but anyone with pseudo-obstruction or gastroparesis or some of these other motility problems, while they are struggling, they may think, oh, my God, nobody understands, the world is falling apart. And truly, that does happen. However, in that whole process, through my own personal experience, as well as seeing what has evolved in people who have been part of this organization for years, I see that their sense of purpose just changes. And through all of these struggles, the good part is that you are educating people, you are changing lives, you are informing people, you are, you know, sprinkling all of your story to so many others. And that's why I say when you put your head on that pillow at night, everybody should feel good. Laura had this great experience with one of our members a while ago, which we were just talking about. But when you are at your lowest point, it's always good to put your head on that pillow and say, but you know what, through all of this struggle, I know good is happening. And
right.
you are making a difference in other people's lives. Even if it's a nurse who comes over and never heard of it, and then you start talking about it, it's just absolutely amazing. And sometimes when we're going through these struggles, we don't even realize it's happening. We're just dealing with all of our suffering. But maybe it's because I've been going through this for so many years. You really, it's life-changing for you, not only in a very challenging way, physically, emotionally, and all of that, but there's always that little good spark that if you didn't get sick, your life would be totally different, and you would be perhaps touching people, but you are doing it in a very, a very unique way that, for some reason, and for those of you who know me, I have tremendous faith. In my eyes, God picked you. And, you know, it's certainly not the path that you would have wanted, but there's something in there that, you know, everybody's laughing.
Right.
Sign me up for this, you know, GI symptoms. Of course, something that people have really not heard of, and there's no real adequate treatment for it.
Right.
Yeah, sign me up. Go ahead.
I wanted to hold out a ray of hope to people with pseudo-obstruction. Mine, prior to May of 2011, had gotten to the point where I was totally TPN dependent, spending more time in the hospital than out, just one episode after another. I had a G and a J tube and a suction machine underneath my bed, and I was hooked up to suction 24/7 to try and keep me out of the hospital. And the doctors and surgeons put their heads together and decided that the best bet for me would be an enterectomy, just to remove my small intestine, which is all that I have left. And when they got in, they brought in a transplant surgeon from Mount Sinai. And he thought that my intestine could be saved. And it was a 10-hour surgery. But he did something called a small bowel tapering surgery. And he brought my small intestine down from a totally non-functional 6-inch diameter down to a 1-inch diameter, and it gave me a couple of years of not completely symptom-free. I still had the gastroparesis. I still had the short gut syndrome. But the pseudo-obstructions, those episodes were very few and far between after the small bowel tapering. It's not a permanent fix. My intestines are becoming distended again, and I'm having more episodes of pseudo-obstruction. But there is a surgery out there that can provide years of relief from the symptoms of pseudo-obstruction. And I just wanted to, that was my main reason for joining the forum today, was to get the word out that a small bowel tapering surgery could make all the difference in your quality of life for at least a few years.
Candace, what I want to do is we're going to recap your story because some people are just getting on now, and I want to make sure that everybody can hear what you went through and how this has helped you, if not temporarily, but at least it's something that a lot of people may not have even heard of.
Right.
So let me just put you on hold for a moment.
Sure.
And let's just settle in here. We have like a full house of people, and they're still coming on. And I know we're running a little bit late for those who came. But let me just welcome everybody here on behalf of the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders. This is our second meeting for pseudo-obstruction, and I'm just so delighted that all of you are able to join our meeting today. For those of you who are new and don't know me yet, my name is Mary Angela. My last name is DeGrazia DiTucci. I'm a longtime patient who does have chronic idiopathic intestinal pseudo-obstruction, which over the years, unfortunately, has progressed to include multiple digestive motility disorders and a host of other non-digestive diseases. In 1991, I was just very privileged to have been able to start the Association of Gastrointestinal Motility Disorders, which is a nonprofit international organization which provides support, education, awareness, advocacy, and promotes research into this very specialized area of gastroenterology. During this program, I want to encourage you all to share your input, your questions, concerns, suggestions, and experiences as they relate to chronic intestinal pseudo-obstruction. We do want to make sure that anyone who would like to join in the conversation has the opportunity to do so. So we ask that everyone be certain not to monopolize the conversation, especially where we only have 1 hour of talk and so many people joining this meeting. And we also ask that you be mindful of other people's privacy, so please do not share any of your contact information during the program or request any information from others. If you're interested in communicating with somebody else, you can just at the end of the program ask me, and then I will have our organization contact that person and see if they're interested as well. And lastly, please state your first name or an alias name if you don't want to use your first name, and do that before you talk so that we can identify the voices of the person. And if you find it difficult to join into our conversation, please feel free to just call out my name, Mary Angela, and I will be certain to facilitate you into that conversation. I was going to talk about some of the experiences that had happened to me, and but because of the amount of people on this line, and because I think we have some really, really great potential for a really informative and supportive group today, I would just like to say that I realize that it's hard to recap years of medical journeys with the very limited amount of time we have. And I also know that our conversations are probably going to lead to many different avenues of topics related to sugar extraction. But a reminder that these meetings will be taking place each month. And as they occur, I am totally confident that each person will come away with not only more knowledge, but that much needed support, hopefully new friendships, but always with hope. And on that note, is there anyone who would like to begin telling us what brings you to the support group meeting today? And please, a reminder to state your first name. I know at the beginning we were just talking to Candace, and Candace was telling us about some of the experience that she has gone through. And with that, some hopeful information on what has temporarily been something that has been working for her. Candace, do you want to start?
Sure, I'll start. I've had gastrointestinal issues for the last 25 years, starting with colonic inertia. Lost my colon in 97. I have an ileostomy and about half of my small intestine left. And my pseudo-obstruction episodes started getting closer and closer together till I was spending more time in the hospital than home. I had a surgically in-place G and J tube, which were used to attach to a suction device under my bed 24/7 that helped minimize the number of hospital stays, but not greatly. I had, on my birthday, as a matter of fact, in 2011, they were planning to do an enterectomy, which is the removal of my small intestine entirely. This was my team of surgeons at Mount Sinai Hospital in New York City. And they brought in a transplant specialist to make sure that nothing was done during the surgery that would keep me from later being a transplant candidate if I developed problems from long-term TPN use. I was totally TPN dependent. The only thing that I took in orally was ice. At any rate, in a 10-hour surgery, they did a lot of resecting and removal of adhesions from prior surgeries and that sort of thing. But the main part of the surgery was a small bowel tapering surgery, which took my small intestine down from a 6-inch totally non-functional diameter to a functional 1-inch diameter. And for, well, we're going on 3 years now, it has improved my quality of life. I was able to get rid of the G&J tubes to get off TPN for a period of about 8 months, but I lost 30 pounds during that 8 months, so I was put back on TPN. But my waist diameter going into surgery was over 5 feet, and I weighed 161 pounds. Coming out of the surgery, my waist diameter was 30 inches, and my weight was 128 pounds. So they removed over 35 pounds of impacted stool from my small intestine. And a lot of people are not aware that this surgery is available. I don't know how often it's done, where it's done other than at Mount Sinai, but it's certainly something to bring up to your GI and your surgeon as a possibility for a new lease on life. It's not a permanent fix because, as we all know, SIP is progressive and the intestine is descending again, and I'm having more episodes of pseudo-obstruction. as time goes on, but it gave me a really good year and a pretty good 3 years. So I just want to throw that out for everybody to consider as a possible fix, at least
temporarily. Yeah, it's
nice
to start the program off on a note of something that is working and something that is hopeful. And I know some of you may be in different parts within your life and may have had so many surgeries. I just want to say one thing, that depending on the pseudobstruction, it isn't necessarily progressive. Some people will have pseudobstruction and it just remains in one area. It depends if it's a secondary, if it's idiopathic, or if there was surgery that caused it. There are many different factors on that. I know a lot of people, when they read our website, and they panic and they go, my God, that means this is going to happen, this is going to happen. Not necessarily. And
right.
just like treatments and everything else, it can be very individual in nature. What works for one may not work for another. If you get these symptoms, some other person may not. Some people
right.
are very functional with it, which is amazing to me. But and some people are totally debilitated. So it kind of depends, and that's what's very hard to grasp as patients as well as the medical community.
It must be frustrating for the doctors as well as for the patients.
It can be. It can really be a struggle. And I know with my physicians, and there's really nothing they can do for me after all of these years, but I always thank them and make sure that they hear my voice in saying that as difficult it is as it is for me to live with this and the impact it has on my family, I understand how challenging it must be for you as a doctor not to be able to do anything except, in this case, just monitor me and be there for me.
Right.
There's not much else. Is there anybody else who has would like to join in the conversation, either mentioning something about this surgery or about something that is bringing them here today because they have concerns or they want to share their story?
Yes, Mary Angela.
Yes? Name? First name?
Yes. Pamela.
Oh, Pamela, hi. I'm so glad you made it today.
I am too. The reason I wanted to follow was my story is quite similar in that I was originally diagnosed with a chronic inertia and pelvic outlet mm-hmm. dysfunction and went through some miserable years and had a series of surgeries at the University of Chicago, not because they were all planned, but because a lot of surgeries went amok. And in the process of that, developed some serious infections so that my abdominal cavity was in pretty sorry shape. And I found out years later, last year, that even the omentum had been removed because of the seriousness of the infection. It took some time to recover from that period, but I did, and I seemed to do somewhat okay, although I was not at the time familiar with the term pseudo-obstruction, although I came up with it when I was Googling myself. I was just being labeled as having frequent partial bowel obstruction, only occasionally leading me to the hospital, and I remained on regular food as much as I could, and my weight would vary depending upon if I was able to eat or if I was not able to eat. I've had considerable trouble with the electrolyte imbalances. Take a little bit down the road. In 2005, I became quite thin with a BMI of about 16, and I was admitted at University of Chicago, and they did decide they would be doing a surgery on an elective basis, and I had an adhesion taken down and some hernias repaired, but the obstructions did continue, and was hospitalized at a local hospital in 2009 because more than 3 years of time had elapsed, And although I spent lots of time and money at the University of Chicago, at that point, they would only schedule an appointment if I were to first send them rules of record that I might have done on the outside. And so I elected not to go back and to try to deal with more local doctors. In 2012, I had gotten very sick again and lost a lot of weight. I had the ileus, and things just weren't working. And I had to be admitted on an emergency basis. The vomiting had become so severe that my heart was stopping. So I was in the hospital for about eight days to get stabilized with the electrolytes and was on TPM. The gastroenterologist I was working with at the time was totally blown away, didn't have a clue. He, because I had some bleeding with the obstruction into my oxygen bag when I was admitted, was operating under the pretense that it was what he had thought in the past, that it was an episode of the gastritis that had become more severe, the acute gastritis that might have led to an ulcer bleed. And so there was an experienced surgeon there that I had seen in 2009 that took over my case and the testing, and he ordered the TPN and the MG tube to kind of get me settled down. I was otherwise, you know, suffering in the hospital room for like 4 days before I said I wanted my care turned over to the surgeon and not from the GI doctor. And he was able to get me stabilized and get me on the TPN and get my strength back. And to make a long story short, he did some repairs of the hernias, and this year did some more testing to see what was going on. And we found out through a CT enterography with what's called volume and contrast, which is a more slippery contrast than barium, that my small intestine, which I do have the majority of it, is quite distended, and he didn't tell me the width, and I'm going to be picking up a report soon, but the width of it is large. He just used his hands to show that it was large, and that basically the same thing that had happened to my colon prior to its removal in 1999 had happened to the small intestine, and that's why I was dealing with it, because you have a motility problem. But he's a surgeon, and he says, I don't really see that you need surgery at this time, but he's very knowledgeable, and he said, I'm welcome to come and see him annually if it makes me feel better, or on an emergency basis, he can handle my care. So in the meantime, I've looked at your website, and I found one of the doctors in Chicago and made an appointment with that doctor at Rush, and I also, prior to that, had made an appointment with a doctor at Northwestern. So I'm awaiting two consults in Chicago for the end of May and the end of June with those two doctors to see what they're advising. I'm existing on sometimes in bed, but I'm existing on liquid food that I make for myself, and I use a juicer for the vegetable and fruit aspect. And when I'm on the road, I rely on Boost. And I'm calling from a coffee shop because the lattes are
oh, wow.
Get through the day. But I drink in small quantities frequently throughout the day, and mostly always have pain. That's my story.
Well, it's, you know, I'm just so sorry that you've gone through such a long process. But you know, you brought up some points that I'm sure everybody can relate to, and one is that of diet. When you have food obstruction, unlike some other medical issues, there's a piece of paper, or you find something on the internet and you go, oh, okay, we can try this, this is it. But food obstruction, again, is so individualized that some people are on tubal feeding, some people are on a liquid diet, some people are able to eat even junk food but not other foods. Other people will eat baby food. Some people are able to eat like certain things that don't have dairy in it or don't have a lot of gassy fiber in it. So it's very individual, but when you find, and in many cases, what happens with patients is their repertoire of foods that they select becomes smaller and smaller. And we call them our quote unquote safe foods in many instances, even though those aren't even really safe because you just never know when the symptoms are going to become exacerbated. But because you have gotten a bad reaction from so many other foods, you become even more fearful of trying different things. I don't know if any of you have experienced that.
I just wanted to add that I have to go with pretty much room temperature food and definitely no ice. That was at the surgeon's advice, and I found it to be true, and certainly nothing, no fizzy drink.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is that when we're going through this whole process of the unpredictable way that the symptoms come on and how it affects the quality of your life and trying to get day to day, let alone moment to moment, it's very, very difficult, both physically and emotionally, what you go through. And I always say that when we're going through these types of motility diseases and disorders, you go through this process of mourning, and you mourn the loss of your health, you mourn the loss of your ability to eat normally and enjoy it, you mourn the loss of social activities that perhaps you could participate in, sometimes you mourn the loss of relationships because they stop communicating with you or they just don't understand. And with some diseases you go through that and then that's it. You lead to acceptance, but because of the nature of pseudo-obstruction, it's a continuous process. And even though you may come to the point of acceptance, suddenly when these symptoms come on in such an agitated manner, you have to go through that whole process psychologically again. And it's not unusual for somebody to just, you know, say, I've accepted this, and then some food or some person will say something and it triggers it. And I know that's what's happened to myself, and it has, I'm sure, happened to so many others on this call. Does anybody want to speak about that aspect? No. I think another challenge that people go through, and I was talking to Candace and Laura about this, is that people feel that once, many people feel that once they have pseudo-obstruction, their purpose in life is gone. That's it. But truly, I have found throughout these years that that isn't so. None of us would have picked having pseudo-obstruction as the journey that you would take. If you ever did desire that, then I'd love to meet you. I would not be the first one on the list, I will tell you, to volunteer for this type of a life. However, that being said, I know at the beginning of my journey, I was struggling with that so greatly because I had to give up my loss of my job that I loved and all of the things that were related to that. I had to give up the prospect of having children. I had to give up the prospect of travel and, oh, you know, it just went on and on and on. And
exactly.
I said, well, what am I doing here? I have pseudo-obstruction. I'm just holding on to life by a thread. What is going on? And then I realized as the years went on, and 1991, of course, I started this organization, and I'm so blessed to have been able to do that. And as I even talked to more people, I realized that, all right, your purpose in life is even greater than had you not had pseudo-obstruction. You are going through your own struggles, but by doing so, you are educating people, you are making them aware of it, you are inspiring people, you are touching hearts, even though you may not even realize it. And when you put your head on that pillow, you need to think, all right, I still have a far greater purpose than I ever imagined. And even though I wouldn't have picked it this way, this is what I've been given. And out of the whole world, for some reason, you got picked for this. And now your purpose is really so great because of all that you are doing and oftentimes not realizing you're doing. Laura, we were talking about her experience with, she's a volunteer for our organization. And Laura, do you want to speak about your experience with your purpose in life? Is Laura still there?
I think
no,
not.
Sounds
like, I
oh,
would
okay.
just like to say for all of us, thank you for creating this group. Because this is Candace again, I'm sorry. Because as I said before, it really has given me a sense of purpose and made sense out of everything that I've gone through. And the people I've met along the way have been, you know, terrific. I've made a lot of friends, and it also helps with the isolation. I think isolation is one of the worst parts of having a chronic illness, because we people we're social animals. We're not meant to live in isolation, and when you become pretty much bedbound or housebound, you find out who your friends are, because those who are not truly your friends disappear over the years, and those who are really your friends hang on. But the online support group gives you a chance to connect with other people, and I think that's really an important part of coping with the disease.
It is. It's a huge part. And I am always just so grateful that when I hear people say that both our online community and programs like this really mean so much, because it makes you feel like you are not alone, that you're among people that understand. And sometimes this is the very first time that people have even spoken about their journey or heard others. Voices that are saying, yes, I have pseudobstruction. And, you know, if you went someplace and said, I have pseudobstruction, a lot of people would be looking
look
at you
and
say, all right, yeah,
said,
what's
I have
in
two
it?
Heads.
Yes, exactly. And pseudobstruction, it has a very unfortunate name. With that pseudo, and perhaps many of you have gone through this in your journey of trying to find a diagnosis, and I know I did with myself, the pseudo in some doctors, nurses, and general public can have that connotation. Oh, it's pseudo. That means it's in your head. Doesn't exist. You're stressed. You have anorexia nervosa. You are, you know, it's just all in your head. You're making this up. And that complicates things in trying to find that diagnosis or finding that position or those people in your lives who will take the time to understand and listen. I bet all of these people.
Mary Angela, as a psychologist, it was very, you know, personally to my career offensive to even, you know, think that this was all in my head, you know, like, but because I was a pathologist, I've been under psychiatric care since 1998 because, I didn't want to not get the best of care for my mental health at the time I was taking care of my physical body.
Mm-hmm. I can only imagine being a psychologist and having to go through this, and sometimes it's difficult for anybody to get that help that they need, but to go through that, and I encourage anybody who needs it to get help, because it sometimes is so big and it is absolutely life-changing that to do it alone can be a huge challenge. And especially
right.
if you don't have also a lot of support in your family or friends, that makes it even worse. I have found in my experience that I've been totally blessed to have a wonderful husband, wonderful understanding family, friends, even though at the beginning, you know, a lot of relatives outside my core family were disbelieving me, I still had those people in my life. I have a strong faith, and I've got a very good or bad, however you look at it, stubborn streak, which all has helped me get through this. But I have spoken and communicated with so many people who do not have all of that in their life, and that makes it far more difficult in my eyes.
Right. I was fortunate, Candace, again, I was fortunate enough to be in therapy already when I had my ileostomy and then had the pseudo-obstruction manifest itself. And I remember him telling me one time, you would have to be crazy not to be depressed, which somehow was very freeing.
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
To hear that my depression was completely normal for somebody in my situation.
Right. Yes. University had so many complications. I just want to agree with that statement. The gastroenterologist who had been with me through all the surgeries and the complications at the university, she said, you know, all the things that happened to you happened to less than 100 of our patients, and you can't not but be suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah, and it's true. I would say that the majority of our patients either do suffer from depression or have suffered from depression, sometimes previous, but as a result of trying to cope with living with pseudo-obstruction and all that it encompasses. And that's why I keep encouraging people to get the help. Don't try to do it on your own if you feel you can't, because this is like a cancer, in which case it infiltrates not only your body, but every aspect of your lives,
yes.
Every aspect. And, you know, how do you explain to somebody that I have this, I may look ill, I may not look ill, but this is how I'm feeling. Some patients with pseudo-obstruction really don't look ill.
Right.
And, you know, and when you have to say, no, I can't go to this social event, and they say, well, why? Well, because I'm having difficulty, I'm not feeling good, I have all of the, you know, belly distension, I have abdominal pain, I feel nauseous. No, oh, what is it? You know, irritable bowel or something like that. No, this is what I have. Well, what is it? And I have also learned in my life that there are some people that you explain everything to. And even though they may, well, if you have pseudo-obstruction, you get it. If you don't have pseudo-obstruction, then at least they're grasping something. Like my husband has said over and over, I don't know exactly what you're going through, but I'm trying to understand and I'm here for you. You know, something like that is huge for a patient. And then there are other people who you just tell a little bit and that's all they're capable of learning, or that you just don't want to go into. Then there are people who you don't share anything. Maybe you've tried or you realize through your life that they're incapable of understanding. So why bother keep on trying to convince them that you have a real genuine illness that is really so huge that it does affect every aspect of your life and they're not going to understand, because you may not look ill or they may not have heard of it, or they're just thinking of them. Some people get so wrapped up in their own lives, they don't have room to listen to anybody else, wherever it may be. But I'm sure many of you have had trouble trying to explain to other people, even in the medical community or outside the medical community, your family, friends, work people, that this is what you're going through.
I just pray for people at social gatherings to have tolerance for an attendee such as myself that may not be able to indulge in food, because I'm rarely invited to a social event that doesn't involve food. And if I'm not able to eat what they have, and I might, you know, on the way there or maybe go into the bathroom, have a booch or something to get through the event, and then some of these people, because, you know, you don't know them that well, you don't know that they're not going to understand your story, you don't like to hear this content, like, why you're not eating kind of thing. And because I'm a bit on the thin side, they assume the anorexia, you know, and that hurts.
Yeah, it can be very, very hurtful, very hurtful. And
yeah,
that's the process. Go ahead.
Candace, again, I found that in social occasions that do, let's face it, in our society, social occasions are almost always around food. I find I take a plate and put a couple of things on it, and whether I eat anything or not, or just push it around, that's okay. If somebody notices I'm not eating, I just simply say, well, I have a gastrointestinal problem and really can't eat. And tell me, what have you been doing lately?
Right.
You know, what's going on in your life? Mm-hmm. Change the focus from me to them. And
yeah,
most people are very happy to talk about themselves. And that gets me out of trying to have to explain what's going on with me.
Yeah, that's a great technique. I know it's worked for me, but it took a while. It took a while for that to, for me at least, to be able to reach that point where the hurt was so deep, because everything is focused on food, and with all of the baggage of not being believed and all of that, can come to the foreground of your responses. And then finally I said, look, I have choices that I can make. I can continue to make this, let this bother me, or I can change my way of thinking. And exactly what you do, put the focus on them.
Right.
And it does work. That's the one of the foolproof methods of doing it.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody else used that technique or found something else that helps in social situations? No, it's really, really hard sometimes to find things that patients like us can do outside of activities that revolve around food. And we're making a list on our website of saying, what can you do that doesn't involve food?
Right.
That keeps you social. And we are little by little getting a list of things that people can do, but no, it's not as big as I would like.
No.
That's for sure. Definitely not for sure. And in order to participate in some of these social settings, like you had just said, you have a plate of food and you just kind of push it around, and that's how you deal with it. I know I drink very weak tea throughout the day, and so that's all I have. And people have learned to accept that and adjust to it, and that's great. But some people bring their own food. You know, they'll bring a little jar of baby food or bring some of the things that they've juiced.
Right.
If they're able to eat.
Candace, I went to my son's wedding reception, and there was this huge buffet, and out of the whole buffet, the only thing that I could eat was crackers. So I put some crackers on a plate and thoroughly enjoyed the conversation and watching the dancing and, you know, just the social aspects of it. And I have found that when I get together with friends for, quote, lunch or tea or something like that, I always pick a diner, because there I can always find something that I can eat, whether it's sugar-free Jell-O or just a cup of tea and a piece of toast or a boiled egg. You know, something mm-hmm. like that, rather than going to a regular restaurant where I can look at the menu and there's nothing on it that I can eat.
That's
so
great.
diners are, well, there's diners all over New Jersey. And I know they're not in all parts of the country, but if you have a diner, make them your friend.
That's a good suggestion. Now, some people with pseudo-obstruction do have this autonomic component that goes with this. And for those of you who don't know what autonomic is, that's the part of your system that controls, for example, your heart, parts of your body that you have no control of. You can't control your heart. That beats on its own. And so that's part of the autonomic system. But some of us have this autonomic system that's so impaired that we may get symptoms of feeling like we're going to pass out. We may get symptoms of having a problem with certain smells that will all of a sudden make you feel nauseous or actually vomit. You may have problems with sound being too loud, and that can trigger different reactions. I'm just wondering, you know, I get a lot of questions, do you get migraines? Yes, a lot of people with food obstruction do get migraines, ironically enough. So I'm wondering if anybody also has experienced symptoms that are more neurological in nature like that, where they get these triggers that will enhance the symptoms of what they're going through. Anybody have that? Just curious. No,
Mary,
I'm the only lucky one.
I would just say yes, yes,
yes,
and yes.
Yes,
Mary,
Ann. Hi, Ann. Ann, how are you doing?
I'm okay. Ann, how are you?
Ann has given the most inspirational presentation this month.
Yes.
She's awaiting a multivisceral transplant and organ transplant. And if you missed her presentation, it will be posted on our website as soon as we finish with the edits. But Ann, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I could go individual here and go Laura and Candace, but overall, but to answer your question that you were saying right now, and with also having multiple sclerosis, it can be really hard to know whether or not some of my senses are from that or from the pseudo obstruction and everything else. I live with 24/7 horrendous headaches, and I'm also have become extremely sensitive to sounds and to smell. I used to love the smell when my husband was freshly shaven or had just put on his cologne or something. I cannot stand it now. You have to close the door and put the fans on, and I'm at the other end of the house. So certain things really, really, really affect me. And more hearing through you and through this group, maybe it is more to do with the pseudo-obstruction than it actually has to do with the MS, which they assume since that's more than neurological. So that's interesting fact to hear and to learn about and kind of go, which one could it be correlated to?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good
interesting
point.
Fact.
There's also a lot of connection, now I have this, but I suspected it years ago, which can go along with MS, it can go along with pseudo-obstruction, and that is mitochondrial disorder. Perhaps you've heard it in the news in Massachusetts about this child who has been kept from her family because they have felt that the family is causing these symptoms, even though this patient has a definitive diagnosis with some of the top doctors who are actually part of this organization. But mitochondrial disease is really making a very, very large, I guess they're making great strides in bringing awareness and also bringing research to this, but they're seeing that in many cases there is a connection between pseudo-obstruction, not in all, but in many cases there is a connection to those people who have pseudo-obstruction as well as to some of these other things, and they're all connected with mitochondrial disease. Ian, I don't know if you have been told that or if you were even aware that that could be a possibility with you.
No one's actually, I think, taken it that far. It seems like, you know, and most of you probably get this every time you walk into a doctor's office, there's something new coming about. So they just kind of chalk it up. You know, it would be really interesting to talk with my transplant doctor specifically about that. Maybe they would have a little more information to take it a little bit deeper. But I think my local doctors that are kind of in the same regime, like you said, they just kind of deal with my day-to-day because so much of it is well over their heads, that it's just kind of another checkup on the chalkboard of going, I wonder what's doing that.
Yeah. It's funny how so many... Sure. Who are you? First name?
My name is Wendy, and I have a daughter with mitochondrial disease, and she's been diagnosed with pseudoobstruction. So
I'm so sorry. Well, that's great. So you can give more insight on this.
Yeah, we've been through hell over the years. It's been 5 years, and she's on TPN dependent, has a G tube, a J tube, an ileostomy that's not outputting, and that was one of my questions for someone. Is if anybody has an ileostomy that's not, hers only outputs maybe 25 to 30 milliliters a day. So she's on a change in the bag, you know, maybe once a week. And she has complete intestinal obstruction. Well, let me back up a second. The person who was speaking that you just asked, she'd considered mitochondrial disease. Who is your transplant or what institution do you go to for your transplant?
UCLA.
UCLA. We go to University of Nebraska, and thank God, God love this doctor. He's the one that diagnosed the, we had the mitochondrial diagnosis, but he's the one, no one could figure out why we couldn't get her off the last time. When she gets sicker than the average person. She's the very first time 5 years ago she was sick. They tried to G-tube feeds, it didn't work, J-tube feeds, they ended up life-flooding her to Boston. She was on TPN. We ultimately got her off TPN, which is, you know, fabulous. She was able to eat again, but she would get sicker than the average kid when she would get sick, and she'd have all kinds of horrible constipation and terrible GI issues. And then the next time she got sick, she was in the hospital for 7 months and TPN dependent. And eventually we got her off the TPN on J feeds, where she did well for about a year and a half on J feeds, but not eating at all. She hasn't been able to eat for 3.5, coming up on 4 years. And got it, but we were thrilled. She was on J feeds and living her life, and then she got sick again in September of 2012, and the idiot doctors stopped all of her mitochondrial cocktail and her medication, stopped everything, cold turkey, and she spiraled out, and we've never been able to get her back on J feeds again. So she is TPN independent now, and we went to University of Nebraska for their intestinal rehabilitation program. We were actually, I'm glad we didn't stay in Boston, considering what happened in the Pelletier case, but we were going to do the intestinal rehab there, but it's so far away, living in the Midwest, and the doctor suggested we try to find something closer, and the closest place was in, they have an intestinal transplant and rehabilitation program in Nebraska. So we went there with the intent of going through, you know, trying to slowly push the feeds, and we knew it would be a long, miserable, slow process. We'd been through it before, obviously, when we got her off after 7 months, got her back on, you know, to J feeds. So they started the process, but it wasn't working. They were doing all the traditional things, and which we'd already been doing, you know, so that was no surprise to us. But fortunately, the doctor, part of their work up there, they didn't, you know, repeat all the tests she'd already had done. That wasn't necessary, but they still wanted to do some certain things. And she was required not to have any contrast, you know, prior to the 5 days of testing. In her system, as we all know, contrast takes 2 to 3 days to clear the system. They'll tell you 5 days just so that you make sure it's, you know, cleared and you have good, accurate testing. Well, we went for the test. She hadn't had contrast since January, like 16th, and this is now, you know, February 11th or 12th, and 26 days later, I believe it was. And they started the scan. It was just a DEXA, our bone scan, and they started, and the tech jumped up and hit the panic red stop button. She says, "Oh, we can't do this. I'm so sorry. We stop the test. She's full. She lights up like a light." And I said, "Why?" And she lights up like a light bulb. She's got full of contrast. I said, "Well, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. It's been 26 days. And the last contrast she'd had was gastrographin, which is water soluble. So that didn't make any sense. And it was just a tiny little minuscule squirt to check J-tube placement. And so anyway, she goes, "Oh, and we can't do tomorrow's test. We can't do the gastric emptyum or the or they bury an enema where you have to cancel all these, you know, tests later this week. Well, long story short, in the end, she had a hematuria problem, and they were brought in a urologist and blood in the urine, and he ran a CT scan. He came back in our room, and he says, "Well, everything looks great on the CT. Don't know what to tell you. Let's just, you know, just why don't you take some Flomax?" We'd been through that before with another hospital and doctors. It was, you know, that wasn't solving the problem, but whatever. So he left and suggested Flomax. It was of no help. And a few minutes later, the team came in. 13 doctors came in the room, and they're scratching their heads. GI, intestinal rehab, et cetera. They're like, "Gosh, we don't know what to, you know, we're feeling terrible. We look at you. This was like a month later, into the, you know, month in the hospital stay, and she'd already had bad reaction to anesthesia, ended up in the ICU, just a ton of complication after complication. She truly was sicker than when she went in, and they felt terrible, practically had tears, and I said, "We don't know what to do." And, they were kind of at a loss, and all of a sudden this Dr. Mercer comes running around the corner in the room, and he goes, it was almost like Superman, might as well have had a cape, and he says, I've got it, I figured it out. He went and he looked at the CT scan that the urologist had ordered just to, you know, try to figure out the hematuria problem, and he thought, I wonder if there's anything else I can see on here. Found out that she was chock full of barium sulfate, cemented in. She had not had barium sulfate for a year and a half.
Wow.
It'd been August, like 2011. And so, anyway, that was a whole nother nightmare. Barium sulfate, if you all don't know, obviously it's a wonderful contrast, probably one of the best things out there that's most often used because it shows up and does light up like a light bulb on the X-ray. But if you Google it, barium sulfate is concrete. That is what concrete is made out of. And it usually clears the system within a few days. And they'll even tell you to make sure, you know, you'll have chalky stools, make sure you drinking a lot, whatever. Well, she was in the hospital this whole time. They knew they'd given it to her. But anyway, bottom line is she was cemented, kind of in. So then that was one issue, and they had to clean her out, try to figure out how to do that. They're going to have to do major surgery. You know, happy to say they did not have to do the major surgery, cut anything out. They chipped away at stuff and, you know, did the best they could. In the meantime, they determined she had complete intestinal failure of the large intestine because she just nothing was coming out down below. And anytime they'd give her enemas, the best we would get was some blood. And so they decided to do a loop ileostomy. They thought they had seen when they had also removed her gallbladder while we were there when they were doing one of the – they had to do a separate – she had a GJ tube, but it kept flipping. So they did a separate J, and while they were in there, they did remove her gallbladder, and they thought they saw some peristalsis with the small intestine. So we were hopeful, and they explained to us that a loop ileostomy might be the solution, that literally within a day, immediately after the surgery, she could potentially go back to eating. It wouldn't be overnight, but we could definitely get her off the TPN, back to J feeds, and even oral. So no 15-year-old wants an ileostomy, but, you know, we were thrilled at the prospect of, oh my gosh, she can, you know, go back to eventually eating and get off this dreaded, dangerous TPN. And so we were thrilled with that possibility and, you know, overcame the shock of needing an ileostomy. They did perform the surgery, and when he did the surgery, he did a full-thickness biopsy. And we didn't know the results for that. You know, it took 5 days or whatever to come back. But they initially were thrilled because we're starting to see some stuff come into her, you know, ileostomy bag, because nothing has been coming out below, not even mucus, which you would expect to see something from below, and nothing had come out in months. So we are thinking, oh, this is great, but the doctor knew something was wrong because it should have been producing 1,000, 1,500 milliliters through that ileostomy. At the very least, even TPN dependent, he said 500 milliliters should be coming out that bag a day. And because the stomach produces 1,000 to 1,500 milliliters just in gastric juices a day. And sure enough, the full thickness biopsy came back showing some caudal cell differentiation. And there's, as you just mentioned, they are starting to link some of this in the literature, consistent with what they found in the literature for mitochondrial disease. So she was diagnosed with pseudo-obstruction consistent with mitochondrial disease. And they stopped trying to push the feeds because they realized, no wonder it's not working. First of all, the cemented in. Second of all, the small intestine wasn't working right. And anyway, long story short, she's TPN dependent. Has a G tube that drains 24/7, except for when she gets meds. And her J tube was used for meds are CoQ10 and iron, but they've just stopped that, and we're trying to do that through the G. So the J is, at the moment, we're not using the J. And ileostomy is not producing, and she's 100% TPN dependent, which, you know, as a parent, it's frustrating because I don't see, you know, we were working for so long trying to get her off the TPN, but now I don't know that that's, I don't see an end in sight at the moment for that.
Yeah.
Mary Angela, can I interrupt for a moment? This is Anne.
Yes, Anne, certainly.
Sorry to interrupt. I just want to say it's thank you for sharing your daughter's story, and there are so many similarities and horrible things that she has gone through that are very, very similar to my story. I would love to talk with you more about that. I had the J-tubes, G-tubes, had failure with them, had failure with TPN. You know, right now, knock on wood, doing okay with TPN. That's one of the reasons for the transplant is due to the fact that most of the time my body does not respond to the TPN. So it's more that ultimate life-saving versus being able to be full-time TPN dependent with it working well. But with mitochondrial, that's really interesting that is all linked with that. But well,
and I
your
think
it'd story
be worth
is just
talking,
amazing.
Yeah, your doctor might want to talk to us because he, at our last visit on February 4th, we drove up there to visit with him, and he said that he has since gone back, he's learned so much. He never had a mitochondrial patient before, and he's been open-minded about everything, which has been great because Tricia obviously didn't fit the mold, the traditional intestinal rehab, and she was a great kid, no psychological issues, thank God, and other, you know, problems that one might expect or wouldn't be surprised to have, and she was doing everything they were asking her to do, but it just wasn't working. And so he, you know, when he found this, that when that test came back, and, you know, and then the ileostomy wasn't, you know, producing, it just made sense to him. Well, since then, he's had about four other patients, he told me, that are adults, not children, but he said that then no one could explain. They've been all over the place. They've been through hell. And he went back, and they had biopsies done, and he went back, and he called this pathologist back recently, a few months ago, as a friend of his, and this one of the top pathologists, he called him back, and he said, hey, pull the slides on this patient, this patient, this patient, this patient, and, well, you know, I want to look at those. I want to see if they have anything in common. And apparently he said that their pathology slides were similar. And these other people had not been diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, but he's thinking that perhaps they may have it, and my daughter's situation may help them better understand their situation. So that's all, you know, great news there, may help those patients. The frustrating thing is we will always have people questioning our diagnosis, you know, the diagnosis. Like I went back and I asked the doctors in Boston, you know, I sent them a letter with the pathology reports and the plan and from our mito doctor in LA and our intestinal rehab doctor in Nebraska. And I've got this fabulous letter saying what they found and what the diagnosis is, the mitochondrial disease and the pseudo obstruction. And I said, are we doing, you know, I wanted to know from this motility doctor, are we doing everything right? You know, do you agree? And they're like, well, that's just a judgment call. That's just a pathologist, pseudo obstruction is impossible to diagnose. And it's just a subjective, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, he didn't see my daughter, you know, but it bothers in the back. And he was supposed to, I said, well, could you share this with another, you know, and get back, get back to me. Is there anything else we could be trying or doing, you know? And he never got back to me. So it just, as a mother, as a parent, I don't want to just, you know, doctors can be wrong too. I mean, it makes the most sense. It totally explains everything that's going on with my daughter. It is what I call, you know, the working diagnosis. So we've got the best, you know, truly experts in their field that nobody would, you know, question. And yet, you know, you want to make sure you're doing the right thing. And the sad thing is, I feel like we're kind of coasting right now. It's not coasting because it's dangerous anytime you're on TPN. And she just actually did have shock situation. Just got out of the ICU a week and a half ago.
So, oh my gosh!
And has all the autonomic stuff that you're talking about, the crazy heart rate and lactic acid and blah blah blah. But anyway, hopefully that I would encourage. Maybe we can talk offline, and your transplant surgeon can talk to give the transplant surgeon in Omaha call, and he can share with his
mind. Definitely. Sounds great.
Yeah, that's it is very frustrating when even that's what happened to that girl, and I'm sure it's happened to so many of us, whether you just have that diagnosis, and I put just in quotes because certainly I'm not undermining the importance of pseudobstruction, but whether you have that or you have mitochondrial disease connected with it, and you have these definitive diagnoses in your hand or on your record, and then you go see another professional doctor who, you know, says, oh, I don't believe it. It is just so hard. And
well, what they'll say is, you know, okay, well, I have other mitochondrial patients, and they can eat. You know, they don't have, you know, and it's like, well, yeah, no two are alike.
Yeah,
right.
Those are the people who really need to learn more about it. For those of you who've never heard of mitochondrial disease, I encourage you to look it up. It's those are the energy pack within our body. And the cocktail she was talking about there, in fact, I don't believe if they have yet that they are trying to make that mitochondrial disease like a standard thing for all mitochondrial patients. Right now, I don't think it's covered
by
insurance.
It's not right now, and it's not covered by insurance, which is unfortunate, but they're hoping.
Yeah. They are doing studies with EPI. I don't know if you are familiar with that, EPI 743. Mm-hmm. It's in a phase two, something like that.
Right, but that's only for, I think, like Crohn's
right
or Leber's or a certain type of named mitochondria.
Yeah.
98% of mitochondrial diseases are not named, and the few that are, it's only for that.
And so that's a misconception. One of the misconceptions about that is if you have the clinical signs, but then the blood test comes back and that's negative, and then you come back with a biopsy, muscle biopsy, and that comes back negative, a lot of people assume that, well, then you don't have it, but that's untrue. It doesn't necessarily need so, and that's the importance of going to a doctor who really is knowledgeable or willing to learn about mitochondrial disease. But there
that's
is a
what's
very,
so
very
upsetting
close
about Boston, because she went to the best. I mean, Dr. Corson is one of the top in the country, and that's just so disturbing about that. And so is Dr. Flores, the motility specialist who did her procedures. It's a really unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
And they're the ones who didn't. They're the ones where you got the definitive diagnosis, or those are the ones who said no?
Oh, Boston. Oh, they never said no. The doctor there, we have good experience in Boston. The doctor there said, he says, I have a lot of mito patients, the motility specialist. He said the treatment, whether it's mito or it isn't mito, he says whether it is or isn't mitochondrial disease, or whether people believe in mitochondrial disease or don't believe in mitochondrial disease. I mean, first of all, it is real, but whether they believe or don't believe, he said the treatment is the same. You know, which is supportive treatment or trying to, you know.
Yeah.
So we liked him. I mean, he was very good. The interesting thing though is, you know, I asked him too. I said, do you think, is there a chance? Could it be in her head? Could it be psychological? Could, you know, back, you know, nobody wants that diagnosis for your child of mitochondrial disease because it is horrible. There is no cure, you know, right now. But I point blank asked him because I wanted to know what he thought, you know, thought. Do you think we're crazy? Do you think we're crazy parents or crazy kid or whatever? And he goes, absolutely, looked me right in the eye and says, absolutely not. This is what's disturbing to me when I think of the Justina Pelletier case. He says, absolutely not. He says, oh, no, Wendy. He says, if I thought that, I would send you down to the ER right now. And they would triage you, and they'd send her to Bader if I thought that.
Mm-hmm.
Bader's a psychiatrist, and that's what they did. That's exactly what happened to that girl. She went in, and it's almost like, I think, oh my God, is that the silent code word or the thing that the doctors, if they want to get a monkey off their back, they don't like the parents, they don't like the kid, is that what they do? They send them to the ER, and it's the, you know, apparent ectomy type thing. And I think so. I mean, he literally told me that in January of 2000, that the year right before. A few weeks before that happened to her. So, you know, she went in. But I can't help but wonder, the thing that's terrifying to me, I can't help but wonder, that poor child, I mean, granted, my daughter has been to the best mitochondrial doctor, I mean, but she did too. We went in L.A., she went to the one in Boston. She, and we had the diagnosis, but that girl, her sister had, as diagnosed with mitochondrial disease, has a confirmed muscle biopsy. Why? Mm-hmm. Of course they wouldn't do that. That's not the gold standard anymore. And she had enough other symptoms. I think she was early enough in the game that she wasn't as severe. But what's terrifying to me is we were in Boston in January. That's where she had the little gastrographum and J2 place. And we were going to do our intestinal rehab there. But the doctor said to us, Bethany said, oh, this is going to be so hard on your family. It's going to be 3-4 months in the hospital, I'm afraid. And, you know, wouldn't you like to be closer to home where I can at least drive and visit you? And that's why we ended up in Nebraska. I want to, you know, hug and kiss and thank the man right now, because what if we had stayed in Boston? What if we had gone to their, quote, intestinal rehab? Well, you have a full team, and that full team is compromised of PT, OT, psychology. Anytime you're in the hospital more than a week, they'll have psychology involved just to make sure you're doing okay, and it's a great thing. But what if we were there? What if they were trying to push the feeds like Nebraska did, and they weren't working? What if we, I mean, I think we just got lucky in that urologist ordered a CT scan, even though he didn't help us at all with the hematuria. That's a whole other story, and nephrology issue, which we know what it is now, but that guy missed it. But thank God he ordered the CT scan, and thank God our transplant, you know, our intestinal rehab doctor was smart enough to look at it to figure out the barium sulfate, which then led him to figuring out, you know, to do the ileostomy, which led him to the full-thickness biopsy, which explains everything that this poor child who's so innocent, who's been trying to do everything right from the get-go, and yet, you know, was being tortured. In fact, they even tortured her. We were told in Nebraska last year that we would never be quite, no one would ever question again. You know, this, all that she's been through, we've got all the documentation, between the best mito doctor and the mtDNA testing and nuclear testing and blah, 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 and now this GI stuff and his, you know, and his full-thickness biopsy. But we still ran into problems last September. She was in the hospital for hemoglobin issues and in the ICU, and they decided while she was in the ICU that they would drug her up and put her in a drug-induced coma-type state and push the J-feeds to try to get them going and off the TPN, because that would roll out if there was any psychological or whatever issue, too. They're like, oh, we're just going to – and didn't work. It didn't work. I mean, obviously, if you've got pseudo-obstruction or if things aren't moving, the plumbing isn't working, you can push and push all you want. It's not going to – it was horrible. It was torture for her.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
They put her on Precedex, which is a drug used for anesthesia, usually only in the OR, but they did it in the ICU for 3 days, knocked her out to try to push the feeds. And I just think if she was in Boston, what if they just gave up and didn't do that, and they brought in a psychologist who said, well, the traditional intestinal rehab isn't working. It always works for everyone. This kid must have a psych problem. I mean, what, that could have been my child.
Yeah,
you know?
It's very unsettling to hear your daughter.
I just need to sign off now.
Oh, yeah, I know we're over time, but...
But I've enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. In fact, I need to close the program now because otherwise we're going to get cut off. But it pains me to hear what those who spoke have gone through or are going through. And as a mother with a child going through this, that it pains my heart deeply. But I am just so grateful for all of your willingness to share your deepest thoughts and experiences in everything that's connected with pseudo-obstruction. And I pray that today, as you reflect on this meeting, that you'll realize that you are, in fact, not alone, and that all of us are, and I hate using this word, but impacted by pseudo-obstruction. We absolutely understand, and that's a reminder that you all still have a purpose in life. In fact, it's a far greater one that you could ever imagine, because you are touching so many lives by your incredible journey with pseudo-obstruction. And as I close these programs, as usual, I want to remind you that you are all extraordinary heroes in my eyes, and I am extremely grateful for the honor of having you share a piece of your world with all of us here today. You remain in my heart, thought, and prayers always. Thank you again. I hope you will join our meeting next month, and God bless you all.
Thank
Bye-bye.
You. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Mary.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Bye-bye.